Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are slapping all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Mike Flanagan.
Hey, how you doing?
Mike, thank you for having me over today, man.
For sure.
Mike's most recent album, West Texas Blues,
yep,
features Chris Whipper Layton,
yeah,
on drums,
mm-hmm,
Sue Foley on guitar,
yeah, and myself. That's the whole band, just the three of us.
And you on Hammond B3 and,
yeah,
vocals.
Yeah.
We're going to get to this.
Okay.
I jump around a lot.
Well, that's fine.
But we get the plug in.
Oh, good.
Up right early. So go check out that record, but we're going to talk about it. You're also in the Jimmy Vaughn band.
Yeah.
Is it the Tilt-A-Whirl band?
Well, both. I mean, I started out, we just had the trio together, me and Jimmy. Originally, it was Frosty, Barry Frosty Smith,
yeah,
on drums, you know. And then when Frosty passed away, George Raines stepped in. So I was never in the Jimmy Vaughn band for a long time, the Tilt-A-Whirl band. I'm trying to think when I actually got in that band. It might have been around, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, I guess, mm-hmm, somewhere along that timeline. It's hard for me to keep track of all this, but yeah, I think I played maybe 7 or 8 years with Jimmy, just the trio, before I got in the big band, you know.
Because I remember he had a guy, I don't know his name, years ago.
Bill Willis. He was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess he went a stretch with no Hammond.
After Bill Willis died, I don't think he wanted to or felt he even could replace Bill Willis. You know, he was so unique. So he kind of went a different way. He got a stand-up bass player and got a horn section. And then they made a couple records like that. Kind of went off in a different direction, you know. And Lou Ann Barton was singing with him still. And so kind of about the time she left, I did play a few gigs with Lou Ann when Lou Ann was in the band, but then she left, and so then it kind of changed a little bit, because we would do it like we do an organ trio segment in the middle of the show, and then I kind of picked up some of the vocal chores because Lou Ann had left, and so now I think the band, we just got off of tour. I mean, I think the band now is as strong as it's ever been since I've been in it. You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's a solid.
Yeah, it's a great bunch of musicians and
hells yeah,
and Jimmy leading the way. Yeah.
So we got to back up for a minute because you mentioned Barry Frosty Smith, and
yes,
that was somebody that, if listeners are not aware of, I encourage you go check out. Start with You Know What I Mean.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
by
Lee Michaels.
I mean, it was just the two of them.
Just the two of them.
What a groove! One of the best feels.
Absolutely. Hammond B3 and drums. And that was the band. And they were opening for Led Zeppelin. I mean, I think originally Led Zeppelin was opening for them, and then it switched once that first album came out. Yeah, if people... I know a lot of people might be familiar with Frosty because he was such a drummer's drummer. I played the gallery with him for many, many years. 8 years at least, and then but drummers would always come up, and there was kind of a little, you know how the gallery is arranged, there's a little kind of a little pocket by where the drums are,
yeah,
where there's a couch, and you know, drummers from out of town, drummers from in town, drummers, and really everybody, it would go and kind of just sit there in that little alcove and watch Frosty, because he was such a totally unique drummer. And he really, if it weren't for Frosty, I don't think I would be playing, because he taught me probably is probably more than anybody really about music, how to try and play it. And also when I first got the gig at the gallery, I was playing Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There was nobody else playing that up there. And I couldn't find, I mean, it paid $20, $30. You know, there were no lights in there. There was no sign. You had kind of had to know where it was. And to try and get a drummer on a Friday, Saturday, you know, for $20 or $30. But so I had a hard time filling those slots 4 days a week. And Frosty, who, you know, was really the number one drummer in Austin, number one call for sessions and for gigs, he was kind of an intimidating figure. You know, I didn't know Frosty. But I, out of desperation, you know, I did call him finally, and he came up and played a show. And then he told me, I'll play every gig with you, you know, and it changed everything for me because I was still learning how to play the Hammond organ, which is not really easy to do. In a trio setting, you know, drums and the Hammond and guitar was what we were doing. And drummers have to know how to play with an organ. It's a specific kind of drummer, you know, or drumming. And Frosty had grown up in Oakland and had seen, like, Groove Holmes. He had played with organ groups when he was coming up. And, of course, then he did Lee Michaels and all that. So he had a real understanding of what was needed from the drums and also what was needed from the organ. And so he really taught me. And we, you know, people talk about 10,000 hours. That's where I got my 10,000 hours was with Frosty, you know.
Interesting.
He really made a huge difference in my life, you know, and we became, we had a great relationship. I was always afraid that Frosty would just show up one day and play and never come back, because he was known to do that. If he didn't like the music, or if he didn't like something, you know, he had this kind of code, certain Frosty's code of ethics, and I had heard of him doing that, and I just thought that one day that would happen to me. I would do something, and or he would just get tired of the music, or something would go wrong. But it never did. You know, Frosty stuck with me until he passed away, you know, which always surprised me, you know. But it changed my life, you know. It made all the difference, because when I first started playing up there, people wouldn't come to see me. I wasn't that great, but people would come to see Frosty. And when you're trying to put on a show and you're playing two long sets a night and you're trying to learn how to do it and you have to sell beer, you know, you're a beer salesman. There's no getting around that fact. You have to have people there.
And no one's ever put it that way. I like to hear that.
Yeah, Frosty kept people there. Whenever I was in doubt, which was a lot, I would give Frosty a solo, and he would just suck people in. Like, people didn't know have to know anything about drums or music or anything. You just watch that guy, and he was mesmerizing, and musical, and you know, his time was, you know, just right on it.
Yeah.
His timing was phenomenal. I've been lucky that way with drummers.
He had that little kit, that green...
Yes, that little green kit.
Green sparkle.
And, I mean, I remember one time, something happened where he forgot his hi-hat and his cymbal, maybe. And he got an empty metal beer keg and put it next to the drums. And played everything on this metal beer keg.
Nice.
That you would play on your hi-hat or your cymbals. And it was phenomenal to watch. Because he made it super musical. You would think, how can you do that? You don't have a hi-hat. You know, and in the playing with the organ, you really need that hi-hat. It's so important.
Yeah.
Somehow he did it. But he was like that. He was...
Sounds like a New York street drummer on the Buckets or something.
You know, yeah. Kind of, he really made it all work. But he was one of a kind. And so if people aren't familiar with, we call him Frosty Barry Smith, Barry Frosty Smith.
Yeah, where does Frosty come from? Do you know?
Well, I think he came out of Oakland. I'm not exactly sure if that's true, but he was on the West Coast, you know, and that's how he really, I think, got started out there. And when he came to Austin, I'm not really sure if it was the 80s or 90s. I mean, he just played with their band. Of course, he was in that great band Soul Hat, which was very popular, and among other things. But he just seemed to play on everyone's recordings, and you know, he was kind of the go-to guy in town.
Yeah. And that's true that he was known for just not. He wouldn't show up, maybe, on a gig?
Well, he would show up, but if... and I don't want to kind of overstate this and paint Frosty, because this is just maybe a little minor thing that occasionally happened. You know, I'd heard stories, you know, if... And we all know how gigs are, or recording sessions, you know, can go. So, if it just got to be a situation where he didn't like the situation or something, he might excuse himself, you know.
Okay.
But always in the most gentlemanly way, you know.
Gotcha. I mean,
so, he had to like musically what was happening. That was, Frosty didn't care about the money. And the money did turn, you know, it was good, you know, eventually, but not at first.
Because he pulled people in.
But he could have been playing on a Friday, Saturday night, making $300 or $400 or $500 somewhere all the time. And he was losing money doing that gig, but he loved the music, you know. He loved that organ trio music, and he had a lot of freedom to express himself. That's what he was about, was expressing himself on the drums, you know.
That's a big testament to you, exactly, that he was digging what you were doing.
It always surprised me. I think he saw, too, that I was trying, you know, that I wanted to do it, and that he thought I could do it, he just stuck with me, and I stuck with Frosty. And it was me and Frosty, and we had various guitar players, Denny Freeman, Derek O'Brien, Jake Langley, and Johnny Moeller, and Dave Biller. We had all sorts of different guys.
Was it always a rotating cast?
It was always, the guitar players were always rotating. It was me and Frosty and just different guitar players.
So it's not like Denny, was Denny like the original guy? Or?
Well, he was one of the original guys. I mean, it was a pretty small group of people guitar-wise, and they just rotated out depending who had gigs.
I gotcha.
Who was around.
Gotcha.
Derek O'Brien did a lot, and Denny. And that was a special group when Denny and Frosty would play together, because they were very creative, the two of them, as musicians, you know. And so they would just, you know, gosh, go off into outer space. And
right.
You know, sometimes I felt like I was the only one playing at a time, you know.
You had to hold it down.
Well, Frosty was swirling around and Denny was swirling around, right?
Right.
And so sometimes it would be frustrating to me, not that the time was always rock solid, but, you know, I'm trying to play the bass and I'm trying to solo, and sometimes you're trying to do a lot.
Right.
And, you know, the swirling is going, you have to really be on your game. I was on my game at that time. I think I'm less on my game now, but those guys would force you to be. I mean, they were on such a high level creatively, you know, I just tried to keep up, you know, with those guys. But they had a special relationship, those two. And when we played. So, yeah.
So, I mean, again, that's where you get your 10,000 hours, just playing at that level, you're saying.
Yeah. And I did calculate it once, how many hours I played up there, and it was well over 10,000.
Nice. Interesting.
Well, interesting. And also a testament to Steve Wertheimer, because I always say you really don't play clubs. We don't play clubs. There are no clubs. There are only club owners, right?
Hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter that Steve Wertheimer owns the Continental or Seaboys or any of these places, right? Because if he closed them down tomorrow and opened up across the street, we'd just go to that club. Right. It's not the building. It's Steve, right?
Right.
And so Steve was the one that gave me a chance. You know, who has a gig 4 days a week in Austin? I mean, at the same place. I had my organ up there. I just walked in. He made all that possible. But he loved that kind of music, and it all just came together, and he allowed it to come together. I mean, he wasn't making any money when we were playing up there for a long time. And there were many nights even after we got going, yeah, it would be empty up there. You know, well, you might have a good night, you might have a dead night. And it didn't make any difference. And Frosty also showed me how to be a musician, that if it was a dead night, it didn't matter that you played. You know, you came to play. Jimmy Vaughn's like that too. You come to play, and it's not dependent on the audience. You know?
They don't get down.
They don't get down.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of guys, yeah.
They're like, oh, there's nobody here.
What's the point?
You know?
I won't give it all.
Right. And I talked to a friend of mine this week, and he had a gig. I won't name names, but he had a Friday, Saturday gig, and he said Friday was packed, and it was great, and the band was, and then he said they went in Saturday, and, you know, the Stones were playing, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
He said, but the band was just, he said it was like two different bands.
Yeah.
Because there was nobody really there.
Yeah.
And they just got down. But those guys are guys like Frosty and Jimmy. They really taught me, like, you don't get down. You come to play. And you're going to have slow nights sometimes. You're going to have busy nights. It doesn't really matter. And to play for the music. Jimmy's very big on that, Jimmy Vaughn. I mean, I learned from him. You might have a rabid crowd, especially in Austin, that's just partying, you know. They want to party. It's a Friday night. And so for me, I'm like, yeah, let's give them what they want, you know. And Jimmy is like that to a degree, but he's like, yeah, you don't give them everything they want. You play music.
Yeah.
Right?
So he might choose a slow number, in other words.
In the middle of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at first, I was like, I would question it, but now I totally get it, because I'm like, yeah, don't let the audience lead you. Mm. You lead the audience where you want to go.
Right. You're holding frame, not them.
Right. And it's very tough to do.
Yeah, because like you said, you can get caught up in the moment.
Well, and you want to, right? You're there to please the audience. When I say that, I don't mean to disregard the audience, because the audience is everything. You're communicating with the audience. That's what these guys do. They're making a connection with these people, right? That's the beauty of the whole thing. We're not playing for ourselves. Jimmy's not playing for himself, and Frosty's not playing for himself in that regard. You know, they're playing for the people. Mm-hmm. But they want to say what they want to say. They don't want to be bullied into something else. Does that make sense?
Oh, it's these vets.
Yeah.
Was Frosty the same age as Jimmy?
Frosty was a little bit older, and he was in his... I think when Frosty passed away, he was in his 70s.
Oh, I didn't realize.
And then George Raines, who...
he played with Jimmy.
He played with Jimmy forever.
Yeah.
And he was in his 70s. I mean, these guys...
And by the way, George has been on the show.
Yeah, and George is... You know, then I went to George. I mean, I've been extremely lucky with drummers. I've played with so many phenomenal drummers just because I was lucky, I guess.
Layton,
you know?
Again. We mentioned again, Whipper Layton. I mean, that's...
Yeah, Whipper. And, I mean, when I go back, because when I think, you know, like with Billy Gibbons, we do one-offs or we do things, you know, and we played with Anton Figg, and we played with Kenny Aronoff, and I played with, you know, with Steve Miller, with Eric Harland, and...
Didn't you play with Greg Moreau? Is it Moreau or Moreau? I don't even know how to pronounce that name, from Nashville.
No, you know, I never did. That's Billy's guy.
Oh, I thought you were on that record. Maybe you didn't play with him.
Oh, I didn't play with
Got
him
it.
At the time.
Got it.
That was tracked.
Got it.
So, yeah.
Got it. But yeah, you've played... I get it, man.
I mean, when I think of it, it's phenomenal. I've been lucky, because we both know, and I say it all the time, it's cliche, you're a band is only as good as its drummer. It's absolutely true. And a great drummer can make a not really a good band sound pretty good. And a great drummer can take a good band and make them sound great. I mean,
yeah.
Everything's the drummer.
Yeah.
Just the bottom line. Everything's
the drummer. Did George Raines retire?
He retired because he was having some arthritis issues at that time. And he just... physically got to a point it was painful to do it, you know, and so he retired, and that left of course Jimmy had played with George Raines for I don't know 30 years or something,
yeah,
and Jimmy's style as it progressed over that time period, I think was built around George Raines. He played a certain way because George Raines played a certain way.
Yeah, he's got a very specific shuffle.
Very specific. You know, the king of the shuffles. And it's a specific shuffle, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a non-forgiving
relentless
shuffle. And like Jimmy said once, he goes, he said, George doesn't play with you. You play to George, right? George is a rock, and you could be doing whatever, and George is there, you know, the rock.
Yeah.
And, man, he left space. He was a great arranger of, like, we did a song on Sue Foley's record called Jimmy Lee, which was the slow blues we had recorded, and we had to do a video for it. George couldn't do it, so I was supposed to play drums in the video. So I specifically listened to George playing drums on that track. It was a slow blues track. And so I could try and look like I was playing it. And I listened to how he arranged the song as he went, you know, from the hi-hat back to here, cymbal here, or whatever. It felt very arranged, but it was just a slow blues. And it felt arranged because of what George was doing. You know, he arranged it. He wasn't just playing a slow blues. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And not thinking.
Right.
He was arranging it. And
He was playing for the song.
He was playing for the song. And I don't know. He had a great way of arranging as he went along. And, of course, he was in the Antones house band. He played with Doug Somm forever. And he got to play with so many of the legends at Antone's, all the legends, you know, Otis Rush and Jimmy Rogers and Luther Tucker.
Doug Somm, right?
Yeah, like, Doug Somm. I mean.
And humble.
And very humble.
Oh.
And very of a time, you know. We're all of a certain time that we come up in, whatever that is, you know.
Yeah.
And those guys are of that time, whether it was George or Frosty or Jimmy, and they have. They came up at a certain time when music reigned. We didn't have all the distractions we have now and
yeah.
all the ability to see all sorts of stuff. You know, TV had four channels and
yeah.
you didn't watch it that much. And society in general was very music, live music oriented. So those guys played all the time, you know,
yeah.
from the time they were coming up. And I think they had so much experience. You know, it's all experience. It's all hours of putting it in.
It was great talking to him because, again, there was just, he was unlike every other musician I'd spoke. There was a real kind of aw shucks.
Right.
A sort of, oh, okay, you like what I do? He didn't really, he couldn't define it. He wasn't the guy who could explain it. I just do what I do.
Right. He was very humble, and he would say, when he started getting blues gigs. I mean, he's from Fort Worth, and I think once he started getting blues gigs, he became known as this great blues shuffle drummer
yeah.
and all that. And he would say, hey, I really don't... He wasn't a historian and listened to, you know, Odie Payne and Fred Below.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He said he listened to the cool sound of Albert Collins' album. And that's the shuffle that he learned from. And when you listen to it, you go, yeah, okay, I get it. And so he had just a unique style that was his. He wasn't emulating a lot of things. He had his way of doing it.
It's no one sound like him, I'm telling you. That's absolutely,
no.
Yeah. I'm telling the listeners, not Mike Flanagan.
Yeah.
No one has that shuffle.
Yeah, Clifford Antone, his nickname was Big Beat, you know, George Big Beat Raines.
And he's a big guy.
He's a big guy.
Yeah.
And a great guy, a very smart guy, and a very funny guy, and a great writer. He's written a few pieces that I've seen in the last year or two. One was a story of going out with Doug Somm to California and playing, and it's a beautifully written piece.
Are these available online?
Yeah, I got to find out. They are.
Okay.
I'll check.
Because I didn't know that. I have to look into that. I didn't know he wrote.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny because it's Those guys are so wild back then. So wild.
Oh, I bet George has seen some good things.
Oh, yeah.
I no doubt he touched them. Oh, I bet.
Those guys, they have the craziest stories, all of them. But you just sit around and listen to these stories, and it's amazing any of them are still alive. But they have such a breadth of experience and life experience, you know, which is so important to playing music, you know.
I interviewed George in New York City after a Jimmy gig at the Iridium.
Mm-hmm.
And we were outside. It was summer. It was hot. So we were just outside. It was a nice night. And I remember we were walking down the street in like a New York diner.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he stopped and he just looked inside and he said, "What is this place?" Just, I love that because again, it's that kind of, he's just humble enough to say, "The hell is this?" And it was like, it's a diner. It's just a diner. He just couldn't figure out, is it a bar? Is it a club? Is it a, like, what is this?
He had a great,
I love
it. It has a great sense of humor.
That's my favorite George Raines moment. Yeah. But,
well, here's another good one. It kind of says a lot about George. We did a show at Zilker Park. It was called, I think, like the Drifter Returns show or something. And it was me and Gibbons and Jimmy, Charlie Sexton, and George was playing drums. And so I don't think we had a rehearsal or the sound check. What they were working on the sound. We didn't get to play that much. So anyway, we get up there and, of course, we play LaGrange, you know, the big ending. And, of course, LaGrange has that drum break in it, right? Yeah, everybody knows the drum break. I think there were 16, 17, 18,000 people.
Right.
You know, everybody in that audience.
Right.
I mean, 99% of the people know that drum break.
Yeah.
We get to the drum break, and George messed it up, you know. And then afterwards, we were laughing.
Did he just play through it?
I can't remember what he did. It's on video somewhere. He did something. He didn't do the drum break.
Right.
Something. Anyway, so afterwards, I was like, what happened? And he's like, well, I don't listen to that kind of music. I didn't know that. I don't know LaGrange. I was like, how do you not know LaGrange? You've lived in Texas so long. Yeah, I don't know LaGrange.
She's beautiful.
You know.
That's beautiful. That is great. I don't care for ZZ Top. Who cares?
I don't know that song, LaGrange.
I must have missed that station, you know?
Well, it's funny because LaGrange is one of those songs, whether you're in a restaurant or a grocery store or anywhere, over the course of decades, it seems like you would almost just know it by osmosis. But George was like, he was like, oh, what, you know? I don't know that.
I love that. Come on. So all right. So yeah, that's too bad to hear. By the way, that he's out of commission.
I think he's happy. You know, he put in his time, and I think he does a lot of gardening and reading and some traveling. And
He sounds like he's being a real good old man now. Like he's doing it.
He
right?
is. Yes. Yeah. I think he. You know, being on the road. When we were on the road with the big band. And George is a big guy, you know.
Yeah.
And the bunks aren't, you know, you're traveling overnight.
Yeah, George in a bunk, hard to even imagine.
Yeah, you're over bad roads. You're getting on planes, and I think it had to be hard. I mean, I would think because I thought it was hard, and I would look at George and go, "This guy's in his 70s. I can't complain about the bumpy ride last night."
Right.
And George never would complain, but I'm sure that, it takes its toll. And I think he got to the point where he was ready to do something else, you know.
Did the same thing happen for Luann? Did she get tired of that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I can't speak for Luann. I don't really know. But all these people are our idols, you know.
Yeah.
And let's face it, they've been doing it a long time. And some of them, and I'm speaking generally, people in that age bracket, they're mid-60s, 70s, getting close to 80. I mean, Mick Jagger's jumped around at, he's 78. I mean, some people keep going, and some people at some point just want to maybe taper off a bit and get out of that. The hamster wheel that they've been on for so long.
I get that, but Jimmy's still going.
Oh yeah, Jimmy loves to play more than anybody I've ever met. I mean, he plays his guitar. If you go over his house, right now, he would be sitting there playing his guitar. I mean, I've been over his house probably hundreds of times, and I don't think I've ever walked in where he wasn't playing the guitar. Or if I talk to him on the phone, he's got, you can hear it in the background, he's plucking on it. And he loves to play, and he wants to play, he loves to play shows. You know, we could be on the road and have played, I mean, this happened on this last tour. We got done playing, and our shows were about 2 hours and 15 minutes long or something. And then we got on the bus, and Jimmy sat in the back of the bus and played his guitar probably another 3 hours or something. You know, and then the next day he'll have it on the bus. He loves to play the guitar, you know. So, and that's how those guys get so good.
Yeah.
You know, people wonder, well, how do they get so good? And from what I've noticed is those people that are like that, they just play all the time. You know, it's an extension of who they are. It's how they communicate, and it's what they love. They don't play all the time and consider it practicing. They play all the time because they love to play, you know, just all day.
Yeah.
You don't get good like that unless you, I don't think.
I have to say, I've seen Jimmy many times, and I feel like I saw him the other night with my guest today, Mike Flanagan, and I have to say, I think he's just getting better.
I think he might be. I mean, we did some shows. We did a little Texas run, and of course, we played quite a bit the last few months. I've played with him a long time. He's playing stuff I'd never heard him play before, which says a lot, because we've logged a lot of hours on stage together.
Yeah.
And when a guy starts pulling out stuff that you've never heard, you know, and you're like, wow, like really amazing stuff. Yeah. And he can do anything. I mean, that's the funny thing with Jimmy is any blues song, you know, anything.
Yeah.
He knows it.
He's a musicologist.
He's a musicologist, and he knows the part. He knows the right parts. I mean, if you pull out some obscure Howlin' Wolf song or a Jimmy Reed song or a Lightnin' Slim song or something, Jimmy knows that part, right? He's going to play it like Jimmy Vaughn. But if you wanted him to play it exactly like that, he would, oh yeah, this is it. And some of those things are hard to figure out what the part was, or especially to recall it instantly. And he seems to be able to do that. And yeah, he's a phenomenal musician. I mean, he's probably the best musician I know.
I was telling someone the other night, I'm saying, notice his rhythm playing, first of all.
It's like
I said, completely underrated rhythm guy.
It's like another drummer.
He's a clock. Keeps it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Never steps on anyone else.
No.
When he's doing that. And then every time he actually goes loose, I said, listen how melodic.
Yeah.
Always melodic.
Yeah, his...
He's playing a song.
Yeah, and his favorite musician is Gene Ammons. So and you can hear, he'll even imitate the saxophone slurs and different things that make it sound lyrical. He loves, I think, Gene Ammons and...
Kenny Burrell, right?
Also. Kenny Burrell, he loves Kenny Burrell. He loves real lyrical playing. He always wants to say something.
Yeah. He's not ripping, which is...
No. And he...
Which is so refreshing.
He could.
I mean, how many guitar players can keep themselves from ripping?
Well, it's hard not to. I mean, it's you have the ability on any instrument to play fast or rip, right? Which everybody does at a certain level, right? Yeah. You can do it. It was hard playing with Jimmy when I first started playing with him, because you felt like a horrible soloist next to him. And I still feel that way all the time. But it's like, you know, now I don't think anything of it. I'm like, he's doing his thing, I'm going to do my thing. And,
right.
And so, but because he played exactly what he wanted to play. Now, because people ask me about Stevie and Jimmy, you'll hear that argument. And I say, well, I don't know other than one thing I do know. Is Stevie played exactly what he wanted to play, and Jimmy plays exactly what he wants to play. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, and beyond that, I don't think there should be any sort of argument or curiosity about it. I mean, there's no... I always thought if there was recorded evidence, which there's not, but when Jimmy was 15, 13, 14, 15, I mean, he was the fastest guitar player in Texas. He played Jeff's Boogie better than Jeff Beck. He played Hendrix, but with his own style, always, they say. But he was the fastest guy. He was the, you know, he, what I think, this is all speculation on my part, but I think what Stevie was hearing from Jimmy at that time, when they were young, was what Stevie ended up doing.
Right.
But Jimmy abandoned it.
Right.
After he heard, he says, after he heard Muddy Waters. You know.
But that also seems age appropriate.
Right.
14, 15.
Yeah.
Of course, you're just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And again, we were talking about Steve Jordan before we rolled tape. You go back to old Steve Jordan, and he's...
Right.
I mean, Brecker Brothers, he's showing chops and what... Yeah. And you look at him today, and it's like, no, man.
Yeah.
He has simplified everything.
Yeah.
And it's with age. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, because it's like being a gunfighter, maybe, or something. Like...
Jimmy always just plays what's right. I mean, again, even if you just take that biggest hit, Tough Enough, and I've told people this,
right.
I said, that guitar solo is genius.
Right. It really is.
You just didn't take the time to notice it.
Yeah.
You just kind of take it for granted.
Yeah, I mean, because those guys were basically playing in a trio.
It's a brilliant guitar solo.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, who would have thought of that and made that choice?
Yeah.
The talent is in the choice.
Right. And that's the thing, not only with Jimmy, but with all musicians, and you do realize this the longer that you play, that you have to choose at some point, right? You're making a choice of what your style is.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
What is your style that, you know, you want to have? Because we admire as musicians so many different kinds of styles, right? And I like this guy, I like this guy, I like this guy. But eventually you have to play, you know.
Well, you have your voice.
You have your voice.
Yeah.
But we don't think about that when we start playing, because we're just trying to learn how to play and we're trying to emulate everybody, right?
Right, right.
And we're just trying to learn how to play in a band. I mean, that's the hardest thing, right? For if you're a drummer to keep... I mean, your number one job is to keep the good time, right? And if you're a guitar player, your number one job is really to keep good time, because, which a lot of times they forget, because it's so interesting to solo and learn all the different solos, but you only solo X amount of time. I mean, maybe 10% of the song you got to soloing or something, but the rest you're playing rhythm, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're really playing rhythm most of the time, unless you're in, you know, Weather Report or something, I guess.
Right,
but,
right.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, totally. And that's what I'm saying. Watching Jimmy the other night, and you go, this, what is incredible rhythm.
Yeah. And when he drops out, because sometimes he'll drop out and just start singing, it's like the bottom falls out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know.
And his amp, he blew the...
oh, my gosh.
The speaker, right?
Yeah, blew the speaker. I mean, he drives those amps hard. He has two of them. And he turns them all the way up, and then he turns the volume down on his guitar.
Mm.
So
do little tricks.
Those things are running, you know, pretty hot.
Yeah.
And he kills them, I think, every couple of years. He's got, you know.
It was handled very, very well, very professional.
Well, and you missed the night before where...
No, I didn't,
Were you there Friday?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, where they didn't have the amps? Because that was another thing. Like, the tour manager was supposed to bring his amps from the tour, and signals got crossed, and we showed up and it's Jimmy's amps were there, and he had to play through an AC Vox AC 30.
I didn't know that.
And so then he just shrugged his shoulders and said okay. And
didn't affect his tone.
No, Jimmy always sounds like Jimmy.
Yeah, he sounded like,
you know,
Jimmy Vaughn.
He could play through a PV backstage and it's gonna sound like Jimmy Vaughn, I think. Matter of fact, I think on the Vaughn Brothers album, they did that Hillbillies from Outer Space, where he plays steel.
Right.
And
it sounds like an organ?
Yeah. And I think he played through a PV backstage on that record, on that song.
Yeah.
That's another thing about Jimmy. He's a phenomenal steel guitar player. And there's a few examples of that on Denny Freeman's record, and then on Merry Christmas Baby, the T-Birds did. Phenomenal. I mean, he flew to Hawaii to take lessons with Jerry Bird. I mean, he's very serious about it, and he's a great steel guitar player, and I always try and get him to play steel. He pulled it out one day at the house, and he said, "Well, I don't play steel." And I said, "Yeah, I've heard you on record playing steel. What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, that's something you have to play every day, you know."
I always thought that was an organ, and when I was a kid, listening right. to the Vaughn Brothers record, and yeah. then later when you find out that's him,
yeah,
steel. What?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of in a weird way. That's how I started playing organ, because we were at Antone's. We were kind of the junior house band, like me and the Moeller Brothers, and you know, different guys. And I played guitar at that time, and then I also was playing steel, trying to play like Hop Wilson and that kind of stuff. But I also loved organ players. So there was a John Patton song. I said, I just put the tremolo on the pedal steel because I'd heard Jimmy do it on Hillbillies. I thought it sounded pretty cool. So I did that. We played that song, that organ song, Let Him Roll by Big John Patton. We did that for a while. And then and I would always set up right next to the B3. And then one day I was like, why am I playing this steel guitar, you know, through a flanger to sound like a B3 when there's a B3 a foot from me, right?
Yeah, because we have to establish this. You were a guitar player.
Right, yeah. Early on, and that's how I started. I mean, I'm from Dallas, and so... Or I'm from Denton, actually. Then we moved to Dallas eventually. But the Moeller Brothers and Paul Size, we were all from Denton. And Anson Funderburg was the guy in Dallas. Great guitar player, and that's how we learned to play, was go watch Anson. And Dallas had a great scene at that time. Big Doyle Bramhall was there, he was playing. Denny was up there at that time.
So did you know Big Doyle?
Yeah, oh yeah. Big Doyle gave me my first gig on B3. He hired me. That was the first guy that hired me on B3, because I was at Antone's. I didn't know how to play the B3. I didn't know how to play keyboards or anything. But
A
guy told me, yeah, I just liked the sound of it. I loved it. And then a guy said, well, just find the key that you're in. And then if you count it up three, that's a minor. If you count up four, that's a major. If you go down one, that's a seventh. So that was my instruction, you know. And so when other bands were playing, like Derek O'Brien and the house band, whatever, I would sneak up on the organ and practice, basically, try to figure it out. Just, you know.
Padding?
No, I was soloing. I did just whatever. I did, you know, somehow it all worked. And then after about 3 months of that, after annoying everyone at Antone's doing that, Big Doyle Bramhall came in and heard me play, and he hired me. And I said, well, Doyle, I don't even know what I'm doing up here. He goes, well, it sounds good to me, you know. So I didn't even have a B3. I went and found one. There happened to be one in the paper that day. And
damn.
And I went and found
it. With the Leslie and the...
Yeah, it was a little old lady. $700.
Damn.
And I called her and she said, a lot of people have called me today.
That must have been a lot of money back then, by the way.
So. Well, and I didn't even have it. I mean, it was still a deal for a B3 and a 122, but I didn't even have a 700. I mean, I just scraped that together somehow. And
yeah.
I beat a guy by about 15 seconds. I saw... Yeah. She opened up the door. This guy came into the driveway. And then he said, I'll give you double that. And she said, no, that's what I said I would do. And he got here first. So without that lady, I don't know if I'd be playing, because I didn't have the money to go really buy a B3 and a 122. And I had gigs with Big Doyle, so I had to have one. And so, yeah, I would tote that around. And at that time, Little Doyle was in the band. It was me and Big Doyle Bramhall. Little Doyle Bramhall.
Doyle. Oh, it was just a trio.
DB2, is there?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Well, and Jim Milam was on bass.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. So that's cool. You didn't have to handle bass duties.
No, that was a learned. That was something I learned. That's how I practiced and played. Like, was always with the doing the bass and doing the pedals, and that. Like I thought at that time, there's a lot of different ways to play the Hammond organ. You know, Booker T, or mm-hmm. you know, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, you could be a gospel player. There's a lot of different styles. People always just think it's one thing. You know, well, you play organ. It's like, no, I kind of do this one thing. So, yeah, that's when I was able to. You know, I met Jimmy Smith. He sat me down and showed me a bunch of stuff, and Jack McDuff did the same thing.
Were they just coming through
Jimmy
town?
Jimmy McGriff, they were coming through town. And the first time Jimmy Smith came through town, I opened for him one night, and I mean, I was a novice, you know. And I kept praying. I was like, please don't let Jimmy Smith come in early while we're playing, you know. Hope he's one of these guys that gets here 10 minutes before he goes on, you know. And we were playing the show, and then I looked over, and Jimmy Smith was standing there watching me, you know. And I stopped playing, you know, just stopped. And then I started back up, but, I mean, Jimmy Smith is just the heavyweight champion, the genius of the organ. I mean, he just reinvented the whole thing. And but that night after the show, after everyone left the club, the B3 was still on stage, and he said, come on, and he sat me down on the bench with him, and he played with me sitting on the bench with him for about 30 minutes, you know. And just, I could watch everything he was doing. Not that I could pick any of it up, because, you know, it was,
yeah,
it was like, you know, what does an ant know about the moon? I mean, that's what it felt like.
That's a good line.
You know, and so anyway, but, and the same thing, Jimmy McGriff, and then my big break was Big John Patton. I went and found him. He, you know, he did a lot of Blue Note Records with Grant Green, and
yeah.
And I found him, and I would go live with him for spells, and we would play. He was the other guy I know besides Jimmy Vaughn that just played all day, every day, all day. It didn't matter if he had gigs, and he wasn't gigging a tremendous amount at that time. But he really kind of showed me the ropes, and he said, you can play, you know. And that made a big difference to me, that he said that. You can play. You know,
yeah,
it gave me the confidence. This was before the gallery and all that, because everyone else would say, well, you can't play, you know, or what are you trying to
what
do?
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
You're a guitar player.
You're a guitar player. That's crazy. Yeah. That's too hard.
Did you stop playing guitar?
Yes. I stopped it immediately. Went in the closet. That was it, because I knew the organ was too much. I couldn't do both, you know. If I was serious about the organ, which I was very serious about
it. And also, it's a smart move in the sense of how many
guitar players are there?
Versus how many B3 players in town?
Well, absolutely. And at that time, in Austin, I mean, James Polk was not... I think he was playing at Sullivan's, playing piano. You didn't get to see him on organ. There was no organs in town. There was one at Antone's, but nobody played it like in a trio fashion or anything like that locally. I mean... Bill Tanner was a great organ player he was the first guy I saw. He lived in Austin, but he in the 70s, he was the big guy in San Antonio. He had a steady gig 5 nights a week playing organ trio. And when I knew I wanted to really learn how to play the bass and the bass pedals in that style, Bill Tanner, I asked Paul Ray, actually, remember Paul Ray? He was a DJ on KUT, among other things, and he played a lot of organ music, a lot of jazz organ. And I asked him, is there anyone around that does that in town? He said, Bill Tanner still does that. And so I went over to Bill Tanner's house. He had a B3 and 2 122s in his living room. And he sat down and started playing. It was the first time I'd seen someone do it. Because there was no YouTube or anything. You know, there was, there was no... I mean, now you can, gosh, so many great Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff from the 60s. I mean, you can really see so much. But at that time, I had heard it all, but I hadn't seen anyone do it. How do you do it?
Yeah.
How do you do the bass pedals? And I remember that first day Bill Tanner told me, oh, man, it's nothing. I said, how do you do it? It seems impossible. He said, oh, you just split your brain into this left side, the bass and everything, and your right hand solo and all that. But it took a lot of work. But I think going back to when we were talking about Frosty in the gallery, is that's when I was able to put it all together, because I had so much time to do it. I was able to do it.
So because prior to that, you're a sideman doing it, like you said. Well, Big Doyle gave you the first gig.
Right, Big Doyle gave me the first gig.
And just not to cut you off, but this is in Austin, or this is in Denton, or Denton?
That was in Austin.
Okay.
He was based out of Austin. But I think our first gig was at Caravan of Dreams in Fort Worth on New Year's Eve.
So wait, when did you get to Austin?
Like move here or start coming here? I think I moved in 1991 or 2, something like that.
But did you have the Doyle gig before that?
No, that was after that. Because I was out with that band, the Red Devils, playing guitar on the road.
Okay.
And they had a deal with Warner Brothers, and it was a, you know, a real tour we were out with, you know, for about a year. And so I went with that band when I was living in Dallas. When I got back home, we moved to Austin. So that was about that time.
And you didn't know any of these guys prior to that?
Doyle and all that?
Yeah, that scene.
No, I knew them because they were all coming up to Dallas. And I was coming down to Austin starting in the mid-80s. I came to Antone's. That's how I... And Clifford Antone's the one that really talked me into coming down and moving down.
Got it.
But I knew them. You know, of course, I wasn't really playing that much. It wasn't until after I moved here, really, that we were playing Antone's. We went there, you know, and I saw Otis Rush and Albert Collins, all those guys. You know, that was the real step one education, was just seeing it. Seeing those guys and being in a room with them. I mean, I think you...
Is this when Thunderbirds are the house band?
No, the Thunderbirds were already big by then. Because you got to remember early 80s.
No, I'm sorry, you are talking about 90?
I'm talking about mid-80s. So
yeah, you're right, they were, yeah.
Texas Flood came out in, what, 81 or 82? Right. And then Tough Enough came out, what, 83 or 84? Something like that.
That sounds about right.
I mean, those guys weren't... They were on the road, you know, all of
they
them
were
on the
hard,
road.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, the house band was Derek O'Brien and Denny Freeman and Mel Brown on guitar, and sometimes he would play organ, and George Raines and Sarah Brown.
Got it.
And, you know...
So you're playing with George Raines from back then.
Well, I didn't play with George. You know, we were just the kids, you know. Me and Sue Foley and the Moyle Brothers, all these people like that, we were the D team. We weren't even, you know, these guys were the A team. And so we didn't get to play with them till later.
Now, Sue Foley. Yeah.
Now Sue was playing with them. She was, I remember seeing Otis Rush backed up by Derek O'Brien and Sue Foley and George Raines. I mean, there's a picture of her playing with Albert Collins.
Was she like 17?
She was, I think, 19 or 20, something like that. But she was much better than all of us, you know. She could really play with those guys. You know, we weren't quite there.
She's just a freak of nature in that way, right? That's a prodigy.
Yeah, she's a lot like Jimmy. She's the only other person I know that's always playing her guitar. Like if you call or you go over, she's playing her guitar. You know, and even at that young age, I mean, Clifford brought her down. She started making those records on Antone's. I mean, we weren't doing any of that sort of stuff. She was playing with those guys. I mean, the first night she came to town, he threw her up on stage with Albert Collins, and there's a great picture of it. She looks 12. I mean, she might have been 19 or 20, but she looked about 12, and here's Albert Collins, who looks like a panther. The look in his eyes, you know, and he's got that Telecaster, and he's just hitting that note. I mean, he was, out of all the guitar players, I mean, you could never go on stage with Albert Collins. I mean, that's just like...
No.
That's... You know,
it's good to be young, though, right? So you back to that.
It's good to be, and she, not that she wanted to do it, but Clifford wanted her to do it, and
he felt she was right.
And you know, and it was an experience. It was an experience to be around those guys, the masters, to see B.B. King and to see Albert Collins and see Albert King, and to see, you know, I got to play with Earl King. I got to play with Junior Wells. I mean.
Damn.
I could go on to be in the presence of those people, real blues guys, the legends. You know, there are no bigger names. They invented all this. And I feel bad now for younger people that they can't see it, because I feel like you have, in order to play that music, I feel like you almost had to see those guys in person, like to see it.
Yeah.
Because the way they played and the way they presented themselves, and musically speaking, I mean, I remember watching Willie Big Eye Smith, the great drummer,
yes.
He played with Muddy Waters.
On the great albums produced by Johnny Winter.
Yes.
The Muddy Records.
And listen to, you know, because people say, oh, blues drums. Yeah, I know that. I have a shuffle, and yeah, I can play slow blues, and I can play a rumba. That's the whole blues. Well, it's just the shuffle, right? I mean, I remember watching Willie Big Eye Smith, Calvin Fuzz Jones on bass, and I forget, and Hubert Sumlin, and I think Pine Top was playing piano, and they started a song. And if you just watched any one of those individual parts, you'd be like, that's crazy what that guy's playing. But together, it was amazing, right? It was nothing that any normal blues person, quote unquote, would play.
Yes.
On that song, like a shuffle or something. And they were all playing this stuff, but together, it became this whole thing. You know, it was just so real. And that's why blues has always, it's endlessly fascinating to me, because there's so many different kinds and there's so many different players. Yes. And there's so many ways to do it, right? It's Yes. all different. And I love all kinds of music, but I just feel like, when I learn to play the blues, I'll move on to the next thing, I think. But that Right. would be when I'm about 8,000 years old. I feel Right. like I'll never get beyond the blues, because it's just so fascinating to me how, I mean, if you listen to a Bobby Bland record with the, you know, the huge band Mm-hmm. and the production value, and then you hear Frankie Lee Sims, you know, with Mercy Baby on drums, right? So raw. And then everything in between, the early B.B. King records or whatever it is, the Chicago sound, and it's all regional.
Yeah.
T-Bone Walker, the Texas sound.
Yeah.
You know, we're an extension of the Texas sound, you know, Jimmy and that, and Luann, you know, everybody. It's an extension of it. We're not a Chicago blues. We don't play, they know how to do it, right?
Sure.
And we play Chicago blues. I mean, it's all an integral part. I mean, Clifford Antone changed everything when he brought those guys down. All the Chicago bluesmen came down, and Jimmy and the T-Birds and Stevie and whoever, Angela Straley, they played with those guys and they saw how it was done, but yet they gave it a Texas twist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a Texas sound, you know, and there is a Chicago sound, and there's a West Coast sound, which is more of a swing, you know, and then you have the Northeast blues, and then you've got Mississippi blues. There's so many kinds. I mean, it's just endless.
Yeah.
It's endless. And there's nowhere to hide. I think I love the blues too, because there's nowhere to hide. There's no, you know, you're not jumping through a bunch of 2/5 changes, and you've got your licks that you kind of...
It's not about playing over the bar line.
Right. I mean, sometimes you can get caught up in traps, you know. Like if you listen to Clifford Scott play saxophone, he doesn't get caught up in those traps or whatever, or different people. But the greats obviously never do. But you can. But blues, you can't get caught up in the traps, because there are no traps. There's nowhere to hide on the blues. You're completely... Still the hardest thing to play is a slow blues. I mean, to this day, I think. Because you're completely exposed and trying to express whatever, something, and connect with people. And it's still the hardest thing to do, I think.
Yeah. Tell me something. What was Big Doyle like as a...
Oh, man. Well...
As a band leader, as a mentor.
He was a very calm, easygoing person, you know. He was like he played drums and like he sang. It was very solid.
Yeah.
And he was a very caring, generous, you know, person. And just the fact that he hired me kind of says a lot in a way. He could have hired a lot of great organ players or keyboard players, but I think he also saw, I think we're all aware of this, you want the music to continue. So if someone's trying to do it, you want to give them a chance. And Big Doyle did that to a lot of guys. I mean, Nick Curran was in his band,
Mm-hmm.
Mike Keller, and gosh, everybody. I mean, eventually you'd play with Big Doyle. And he was just a very solid, caring person. His voice was, you know, so unique, and he defined kind of that a certain style of Texas blues that Stevie really, when Stevie had to sing, he only sang a couple songs at first, Texas Flood being one of them. When he was with the Cobras, he would sing that one song or two songs. He was not known as a vocalist. When they had Double Trouble, that was Lou Ann was in that band with Stevie.
Was it Triple Threat, or was that
Triple Threat? That was something else. That was W.C. Clark and
okay,
right. So Triple Threat Review, that was different. Okay. But
yeah, that's right. Yeah, Lou Ann.
But yeah, Lou Ann. Right? He was singing, but then Lou Ann left, and so
right.
I remember Chris Layton telling me, he was like, yeah, she left, and so they thought, well, what are we going to do? And Stevie just said, I'm going to sing, you know. And he had been singing, but only a few songs. But, of course, he was a tremendous vocalist. You know, people forget because he was such a tremendous guitar player, but his vocal
ability. But very much in the style of
Big Doyle. Yeah. Big Doyle, I think, because they had played together, and he really came up with Big Doyle. And he really influenced the way Stevie approached singing, you know. And of course, Big Doyle's big influence on Little Doyle, obviously, who's an unbelievable singer and guitar player, and you know, very, you know, another one of the most talented people I know. I mean, it's just in him.
Yeah.
It's built in.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Charlie Sexton's that way too. It's just built in.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
And he, but nobody works harder than Charlie, you know, and he's the sweetest guy, you know, the nicest, maybe the one of the nicest people I know. Him and you know, all these guys are very nice, and they're all not who you might think they are, because, you know, look at Charlie. He's like a model.
Yeah.
Number one, he looks like a model. He plays great. You think, well, this guy must be.
Yeah.
On top of the world.
I hate him already.
I hate him already.
Exactly. You can't be that.
But he's
handsome.
The exact opposite. Yeah. You know, he's not, he doesn't care about any of that. He's just about music. I don't know anybody that's works harder at music. He's always producing or on the road or putting together an event.
Right?
I'm not sure. I know he's been out with Elvis Costello lately.
Uh-oh.
So I think maybe he's...
I didn't know that.
I think... and then I saw where maybe Dylan has a new band, so I haven't talked to Charlie about
it. Oh, you know what? That could be true. I saw Charlie Drayton as the new drummer and Dylan.
Okay.
So I don't know. I didn't know that. I mean, I know Charlie has left Dylan before.
Right, and I'm not sure. It might be one of those things where he's coming back. I don't know. I don't know anything about it.
I mean, Denny Freeman
was... Yeah, Denny was with Dylan for... 5 years or something.
I mean,
like that.
Dylan really likes to come and handpick from Austin.
Well, Austin, I mean, and those guys created something that didn't exist before. I mean, when you're talking about Paul Ray and Denny and Derek and Jimmy and Stevie and Big Doyle, Angela Straley, Lou Ann Barton, and George Rains, I mean, all these people, and there were a lot of them. They invented a new sound that didn't exist before. I mean, it got famous with Stevie, and it got famous through the T-Birds, you know, at that time. But that sound didn't really exist. And so people like Bob Dylan, I mean, they were immediate fans of all these guys. Eric Clapton, you know, another one.
Well, all of them, as you say. Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, whether it was Zeppelin or the Stones, they all were.
It was so undeniable.
Yeah.
And through Jimmy, I mean, we just saw Robert Plant. I saw him at the hotel a few weeks ago, and we talked. We backed him up doing a bunch of doo-wop songs a few years ago, the Jimmy Band with Robert Plant, and very nice guy. And of course, I never thought I would meet anybody. You know, I'm from Denton. I didn't think I would ever. I didn't play a gig till I was 25. I mean,
that's wild.
I was never in a band. I didn't know. Didn't know that was an option. When I was growing up, I thought you were. I mean, I didn't know people played for money unless you were
on TV,
ZZ Top or somebody, right? Like,
there you go.
Or whoever was popular, right. Big names.
Right.
I remember one time I used to mow this guy's lawn, and he played guitar, and he said he had a gig that night or something. just the term gig sounded so foreign, you know.
Yeah.
If you're not a musician, we use it all the time, but if you're not, people hear the word gig, it sounds so strange, right? I know I thought that.
Yeah.
I said, where are you playing? And what are you doing? What do you mean a gig? He said, yeah, I play at the steakhouse. I play guitar, you know, I sing and play acoustic guitar at the steakhouse. And somehow that changed, that did something to my being, that you could go somewhere and you didn't have to be, you know, Led Zeppelin or whoever to go play and get paid some money to do it, right? That was a novel thought to me, you know. And then the first show I saw, like, people on stage was the Cotton Bowl. Ironically enough, because the Stones were just here. It was the Stones and ZZ Top and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. That was the bill.
I just talked to that guy, the sound guy, Clay.
Yeah, Clay.
And he said this, he saw that.
Yeah. And I mean, I never thought I would meet any of these guys. And I went on to play with yeah. Billy and Jimmy. I mean, unbelievable. Because I was just a kid that had...
Yeah.
I used to play banjo at that time. A banjo. I used to go to bluegrass up in North Texas. They'd have these little bluegrass festivals. Real small.
Yeah.
Hardly called a festival, but I would go and take my banjo and enter the banjo contest. And I won a few of those. My parents never even knew about it. I never told anybody what I was doing. And so I was just a kid who played banjo, kind of, you know, and I played a little guitar or whatever. And then I saw that show at the Cotton Bowl, you know. And it didn't change. I didn't go switch and start playing electric guitars right after that. I mean, I just didn't think much about it. I just thought it was great. Like, look at those guys on stage. And I love ZZ Top. And that's really who I went, you know. I only went because...
By the way, he is wearing a Fandango t-shirt today.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean...
Oh, I love those guys.
Oh, come on.
And to be able to meet... And I mean, I actually got to play with ZZ Top a few times, you know.
You played with the band?
With the band. First time that they were playing, it was a gig, they were playing the Montreux Jazz Festival, and Claude Nobbs, the impresario of that, who, you know, had just passed away, and so they wanted to do a segment, kind of a tribute, and so they were going to bring me on mid-show, and we were going to do this kind of little tribute, little ballady kind of thing that I was going to do solo, and then we were going to play a couple more songs I was going to play with them, like a blues, and then I forget what we did, but we did like three things. Well, I was a big ZZ Top fan as a kid growing up, you know. Me and my brother, we had all their records. I never thought I would meet any of these people, but then to be able to actually play with the band, you know, it was an odd feeling, because I was waiting in the wings. I knew on the set list when they were going to call me, but here they were playing, you know, Give Me All Your Love and you know,
right.
The Sharp Dressed Man and yeah. LaGrange and
yeah.
Legs. You know, I was listening to them play all this stuff, and knowing that they were going to call me out to play with them at a certain point, it was very unusual feeling, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that. I played twice with them, two different Montrose, and then I played with them in Las Vegas. And it was, you know... a dream come true to play with ZZ Top, because I do a lot of shows with Billy, you know. We have one-off things, and a lot of times, like, Matt Sorum will play drums, or Chris Layton will play drums, or, like I said, you know, it might be Anton Figg, or it might be, you know, it's been different guys, Kenny Aronoff, or, and it's all fabulous. But to walk out there and there's ZZ Top and there's Dusty, you know, I had met Billy, but I had not met Dusty and Frank when I played Montreux. So Billy told me, he goes, hey, you can't just be my guy. You can't be Billy's guy. You know, you gotta be the band's guy, you know. So, which I was like, well, great. I can't wait. You know, I can't wait to meet those guys. So the first day I got there, we played the next day. So the first day I got there, I met Frank and Dusty, and it was just like I had imagined. You know, Frank was just like Frank is, you know, smoking a cigarette and, all right, it's nice to meet you, you know, whatever. And then Dusty, but me and Dusty went out and sat by Lake Geneva. There was a little cafe, and we sat out there all afternoon, maybe 4 or 5 hours, just me and Dusty, you know. And he was telling me all these stories and talking about getting shot, you know. This is wild.
Are these very separate personalities, the three of them?
Oh, absolutely. They're very, but of course they're one of a piece. I mean, the magic that they made together is incredible, you know. And it took all three to do it. I mean, Dusty's bass playing, I mean, it's so, you know, there was a style. What made ZZ Top different musically, because it was kind of, maybe you'd say, oh, it's a blues boogie band or whatever. A lot of what made it sound different was Dusty, because instead of maybe walking a bass line like you would, he would just go, bah, 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 you know. And he had these like motorboat fingers.
Yeah.
And he would do that thing. And it's
pedaling?
It was so impossible. He would stay on one note. Yeah. Bah, 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 to do it, to physically do it. I mean, his hand, you ever saw his hand do it? Looked like a tarantula crawling over the strings. And it was just nobody played like that. And he filled up that space. And then he was the soul shouter of the band, the singer.
Yeah.
That. You know, set
I love Dusty on lead. Exactly. It's just,
yeah. And so the three of those guys together, to see them together too, you know,
yeah,
was sweet. Because
and Frank really changed over the years, even his style, his approach.
Right. Yeah. I don't know technically. I do know that when I sat in with him, we started off with a shuffle. It was like a Texas shuffle, and Frank kicked right in. And you're like, oh, there you go.
There it is.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, they're great. And they're wonderful people, you know, too, on top of it all.
Yeah, back to just humble, down to earth.
Humble people, gosh, they've been through it all. They were the biggest, people forget, the biggest bands in the world on MTV were ZZ Top and Michael Jackson at that time.
Yes.
There was no bands that were bigger.
No.
And there was nobody selling more records. And there
those
was
videos were everything that helped launch MTV.
Yeah. But Billy, you know, is still sweet. I mean, we're sitting at my table. These are just things Billy sends me. You know, he sends me stuff all the time.
Oh, that's...
He sends me cards. And it, not just me. He sends it to all sorts of people. You know, sometimes I'll get 3 or 4 cards a week.
He's old school.
Or little presents. And people, he does it to all sorts of people. I think, when does he have time to do this? Because he's so busy anyway. He's always doing about 80 things.
Right.
And yet, in the meantime, and look at this. Look at his handwriting. Look at the time he puts into
the
label.
Great.
You know, some little label. Yeah. This is something he sent me. And then he puts
a
picture. He puts a picture of him. Like, it's this art. It's this art piece.
Yeah.
It's not just sending a note.
Yeah.
Like, I can barely legibly write anything. He's a real artist. Billy is. I mean, he can paint and draw.
Oh, okay.
And his creative process is something else. I mean, he's a very artistic person in the way he lives, in the way he thinks.
Yeah.
But the sweetest person and the most thoughtful person, you know, to other people.
Yeah.
You would never think that. I mean.
Well,
I wouldn't be if I was
Billy. I've never heard anything bad about him.
If I was Billy Gibbons, I'd just be.
Counting your money?
That's right. I would just be like, hey, man, I'm Billy Gibbons. But he's not like that. You know?
Right, right.
Anyway.
Yeah. It's wild. So, okay, so let's go back. So you're doing. The Continental, the upstairs of Continental gig.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's this rotating cast of guitar players.
Yeah.
How does Jimmy Vaughn, is that through Frosty or is that?
No, Jimmy Vaughn loves a guitar player named Dave Biller. No, Dave?
No.
He's a phenomenal guitar player. He can play anything. You play jazz, plays. Now I think he's out with, I think he's part of the Texas Playboys or something.
Oh,
like he plays steel guitar too. Phenomenal. So he's out playing steel guitar, but he can play Kenny Burrell and Herb Ellis.
Oh, okay,
and
okay.
He can play blues just like Freddie King, or he can play AC/DC just like AC. He's unbelievable.
He's that guy.
He's that guy. But as a jazz guitarist, and Jimmy just really loved Dave Biller, and Dave Biller was playing with me, and so Jimmy came up to see Dave, and he would sneak up there every once in a while, and I didn't know Jimmy. I mean. I don't know if I had ever met him. He was always mysterious. He wouldn't, even at Antone's when I was kind of in the little house band down there, we never saw Jimmy. Jimmy didn't come in. I mean, you would see him around town. He had that lowrider dually pickup truck with flames painted on the side, and you would see him with the sunglasses on, like driving real slow. That was about as much as we knew about Jimmy. But he started coming up, and then I asked him if he wanted to sit in, and then he said, well, I wouldn't know what to do. Why don't you come over to the house, and maybe we can work up two or three things, so if I sat in, I would know, you know, what we're doing. And, okay, so I went over his house, and then we just started getting together, and then we started to, I don't know if he ever actually sat in. I think we just started playing all night, you know, together. We worked up a show, a set of some sort, and it was all instrumental at first. I mean, people would come up because Jimmy was playing, but at a certain point I was like, Jimmy, you gotta sing something, maybe, you know, just because people are here, and they're right. Even though, you know, it's very, you know, we're not trying to fool anybody, where this is instrumental, you know, trio, organ trio. But he said, okay. And so he goes, well, if I sing, you know, you gotta sing. And so that's how that kind of started. We started doing that, and we've never stopped. I mean, so that's how that got started. And then through Jimmy, that's when Billy came up, because Billy heard Jimmy was up there, you know, and Billy came up.
But Billy already knew you.
He...
Or no, is no, that how you met Billy?
That's how I met Billy.
Okay.
I had met Billy years before, because oddly enough, he was a big Red Devils fan, that band I was in.
Interesting.
And I had met him at a place in Hollywood called the King King, but he didn't remember it.
Right.
And
right.
Then I never mentioned I was in that band. It wasn't until years later, after I knew Billy, several years had gone by, I never said anything about being in that band. There was no reason to. But the bass player in the Red Devils came up with Billy, and he told him, he said, do you know that Flanagan was in the Red Devils? And it blew Billy's mind, because I'd never mentioned it. And he was
a fan.
He was a big fan of that band. But
that's cool. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
That's pretty. I mean, come on.
I mean, it was great. But anyway, I forget the question.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I was saying so that how did the Jimmy Vaughn thing happen initially at Continental? He was coming up, and he wanted,
and so
it starts slow.
It starts slow.
Sitting in,
it's like any relationship you have. You know, if you meet a girl and you start going, whatever. Yeah. There's no difference. You get to know each other.
The chemistry,
and do you like?
Yeah.
Can you play together?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Will it work? And is it something you want to do? And because people have a lot of chances to do all sorts of things musically, you have to pick. Well, is this worth my time to invest to do this? You know, so that's, it's kind of like going out. You go, well, is it worth my time to do this? Yeah. So you have to explore all that, and luckily it all worked out. And of course, everything that's really happened to me has really, it all spawned from Jimmy. And because once Jimmy gives you the stamp of approval,
yeah,
it does mean something, you know, to certain people, because they'll think, well, oh, he's playing with Jimmy. Well, he must,
sure,
must be something to it, because Jimmy's a kind of, you know, has a certain...
The Godfather?
Well, kind of, and he doesn't mean to be that way, but...
Who else would be?
I think it's always happened to him throughout his career. People want to know what Jimmy's thinking, you know. Does he like the way I play? You know, I think when he gets on stage... Even if he's playing with, like, on that last tour we went on, opening for Clapton, at the end Jimmy would get up with Clapton, and Doyle Bramhall was in Clapton's band. So they would all play together, and they all kind of defer to Jimmy a little bit. Eric just loves Jimmy, and he loves that style for all the reasons that we talked about earlier. He's, you know, kind of like Frosty was a drummer. Drummer's drummer, and Jimmy's kind of a guitar player's guitar player.
Yes.
To a lot of guys.
Yes.
And
all the guys.
Whether it's Buddy Guy loves Jimmy. I mean, Billy just
Jimmy
loves
Vivino,
Jimmy.
Jimmy Vivino, I just heard of something he was,
oh my gosh,
raving about.
Yeah.
They love everyone.
Yeah.
They get it.
Yeah, because he's...
But no one sounds like that.
Sounds like that. And that's, I think, the most... As you know, we all know, the hardest thing to do as a musician is when someone hears you, that someone knows that that's you.
Yes.
Especially on electric guitar, which is, so many people play electric guitar. It's so hard to have a sound, especially an identifiable blues sound when you talk to all, because usually it's just kind of a hodgepodge of Albert King and B.B. King Albert Collins, and it's some rock licks, and it's this kind of, it's good. Sounds good.
Yeah. You're right, though.
But could you define that person from that person from that person? Mm-hmm. Not really.
No.
But Jimmy, when you hear him, you know it's him.
Like you said the other night, he didn't have his amps and everything.
It still sounds like him. And Billy's that way, too. So it always sounds like Billy.
Yeah, Billy, of course.
He's got a definable sound.
Yeah.
So I think that when I started playing with those guys, too, it made me think for myself. I was like, well, what is my sound, you know? And so I changed the way I played, for that reason. And Jimmy had a great quote. He said, well, to get your own style or your own sound, he goes, you may not even like your own style at first. And that's a really heavy quote in a way, because we're built to like all these. This is why we got into it, because we love, for myself, I love Big John Patton or Babyface Willette or Jimmy Smith and Jack McDuff, all these people, right? That's why we got into this. We want to learn how to play like they did, And so when you do something that doesn't sound like they did, part of you doesn't like it. You're like, yeah. But I did get to a point where I was like, yeah, I'm not going to play like Jimmy Smith, and I'm not going to, or attempt, not that I could, but.
Sure.
I'm not going to go for those settings.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do it. There used to be a part of the show in the trio thing, and there's a Jimmy Smith setting, and they all use it, McDuff and McRib, and Lonnie Smith, they all use that setting. It's a particular thing, and I would use that setting. And then after a while, I started feeling like it was a cheap thing. You know what I mean? Because the audience loved it. It sounded so good.
Right.
It was very mellow. Like when I played with Steve Miller, he loved that thing, right?
Right.
But then I thought, well, this is too easy, and I'm not, what am I saying, So I quit doing that on that. So I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do, That's what they would do. What would I do, Even if you don't like it as much, or even if the audience doesn't like it as much, maybe,
But that's the thing. Now you own it. Now it's yours.
Yeah, and whether it's bad or good, you go, well, that's what I do,
Well, I think it's working.
Oh, well, thanks. But yeah, you do feel like, I don't think anyone... I mean, I have kind of a unique position when it comes to B3 because I play blues, and we're doing Jimmy Reed songs. I mean, I've never heard anybody do a Jimmy Reed songs on a B3,
right?
And making it work,
right?
Because you can't your Jimmy Smith stuff goes out the window. Now you're playing Jimmy Reed. Well, how do you do that?
Yeah.
So I had to figure out a way to do all that,
know?
And I did, and it took a long time to do it. It
was Rock Me Little Girl, Come Rock Me, Smokey.
Yeah, all that stuff, Smokey Smothers.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing, I mean...
Yeah, how are you going to play a Frankie Lee Sims song on the B3? I mean, but it sounds good, and you got to figure out how to do it. So that was kind of my thing, maybe, that I added to whatever.
Yeah, I mean, because who else do you think of? You think of, like you said, Texas blues.
Yeah. I can't think of anybody.
That's the beauty.
I think it's great jazz. Right. I have a little niche, and it may be, I'm not a great jazz organist, and I'm not a great funk organist. There's a lot of, I'm
but
not
do
a great,
you want to be?
I don't.
I mean, is there a part of you that wants to do that?
No. There was a part of me that used to, when I first started playing, because I love, how can you not love, Lonnie Smith?
Right.
Lou Donaldson, but then I realized it wasn't really in me. I could do it.
Joe Zawinul. Well, he's, as he,
yeah,
I mean,
but,
I don't know.
But also, I wasn't a schooled enough player. I could never be a jazz player. You have to dedicate. I guess if I wanted to be, I feel like jazz is a dedication that those people pay a price for monetarily, socially.
Yeah.
Maritally,
right.
you know, alcoholically, yes. drug. I mean, I'm not going to say
all of it,
but you're paying a price because you're dedicating. Yeah. It's a way of life. You're dedicating yourself to a music that, a very popular jazz musician like Mike Stern might be playing his 55 bar to 80 people.
Yes,
and then there's a line of jazz guitar players, young ones, that wish they had that gig. Well, they do the math. I mean, now Mike Stern, those people like that, they're the legends, and they're making.
I've had a like living. Every guy who's in that band on this show. I get it.
Yeah,
all of those guys.
And that's a dedication. It's a life. You can't play at it.
No.
And be, you know, you can play at it, but you have to know that's what you're doing. I'm dedicated to what I'm doing, the way they're dedicating themselves to that, you know.
Yes.
So, and just like they feel like that's an endless road for them, musically speaking, I feel the same way, you know. They feel like in jazz you could go to outer space or you could come down to the ground or whatever. I feel the same way with blues. There's so much, so many strata.
Yeah. No, you were doing it the other night. You guys are doing things that have like a touch of like sort of big band arrangements. And
yeah, all sorts of things. And I also feel now, because people have gotten older, I'm getting older, and a lot of people are gone. A lot of people maybe aren't doing it that much. And so when we go out, like with the Jimmy Band, I feel like we're real ambassadors for the Texas sound, you know, that is maybe of a certain era, you know, a certain sound.
Yeah, I don't know who's carrying that.
Because it's not something you can just, it's like Sue Foley, she's been doing this whole time.
Yeah.
With that kind of dedication. So. And, you know, we've been doing the same. And so you can't just decide you're going to do that and be at that level in 2 or 3 years. It's not a fad.
No.
You're with it whether it's working or not, whether people come to see the blues or not. And so you're it's just like a jazz musician. I mean, you see guys that...
You don't get in it to get rich.
You don't get in it to get rich, but amazingly, I look at the B3 at times and I'm thinking, everything that I have, I got because I played that thing. It seems impossible, you know, because I have a good life, you know, and...
Yeah.
And if you would have said, you're going to make your living playing the organ, people ask me all the time, what do you do? I'm a musician. What do you play? I play Hammond B3. Well, number one, they don't even know what that is.
No.
I'm saying, well, it's a keyboard of sort, but it's an old, it's electric organ. And they say, and they just kind of look like, oh, like just a blank stare. Like
kills it right there.
Like right there, they're going, you're not a musician. Like, what's your real gig? You know, what's your real job?
What's your day job?
Yeah, what's your day job? I haven't even heard of a Hammond organ, you know?
Yeah.
And they're not wrong to think that, but... So I'm very, very blessed and grateful and extremely lucky, you know, to be still playing today for someone that never thought they would be a musician. I mean, I never thought that early. At some point I thought that's what I was, you know, because that's what I had been doing. But even at some point I thought, well, I never felt I was the most talented person out of the guys I knew. Like, the Muller Brothers were really talented. People were sweeping them up. Paul Size, the guys I kind of came up with, Mike Morgan, these guys in Dallas, and a lot of gigs. And I never really considered myself in that class. I mean, when I became a full-time musician, I thought, well, maybe I'll do this a year or two, you know. And then it just never ended.
And now go back to the album, West Texas Blues.
Oh, right, yeah.
Was this something you just did on your own?
That was something that the time, like when the lockdowns happened, you know, me and Sue, we did a little, you know, everybody was doing live streaming, but I didn't really know how to do it, but I thought, well, let's do like a, make it look like a, I don't know, cable TV show, local access cable TV or so. So we did this thing, Texas Blues Party. It was just me and Sue. It was B3 and guitar and that drum machine, that rhythm ace. Because we couldn't have a drummer. We didn't, you know, we couldn't see anybody. So we did that for a little while. And then we started playing Texas Blues Party at the Sagebrush, and we needed a drummer. We're going to use it, right? So we got Chris to do it. Anyway, so we started playing a little bit, and then I thought, well, let's go in the studio and record. This actually might have, we might have recorded first. I wanted to think of something to do. So I was like, let's go in. So we went in the studio. I didn't have any song lists. I didn't know what we were going to do. I didn't know anything. We hadn't been playing live in a while. I didn't know it would turn out. We were just recording. So I would just call off songs off the top of my head. Let's try this, or here's one I know, or whatever. We just did that. And we really did it in one day. We set up on Friday, and we played a little bit Friday, but I don't know if anything on the album ended up, you know, from that Friday.
Just
we
getting went in, sounds on Friday.
Getting sounds.
Yeah.
And then Saturday we went in and played, and that was a good day, and that was the album. And then Sunday we went in and started to play, and I was like, I'm not feeling it. I don't feel like it today. Like, I don't feel like this. So I had a whole day of recording that I just said, nah, let's just go home. Because I felt it on Saturday. I felt like we all felt it, and it was great. And then Sunday, because we were recording live, we were all in the room together. I was singing live. We were all playing live. You know, you're capturing a moment. And so if that moment, it didn't seem like we had the energy on Sunday. So I just cut it loose. And then I didn't think much of it. The engineer, I said, just do a rough mix. So on Monday, he sent a rough mix of the songs, and I thought, well, that sounds like an album. And I put it out like 2 weeks later. Like, I didn't mix it again. I'm really like on, like, I've done Sue's couple records. I did the Drifter record. I mean, usually I'll mix a song 6, 7, 8 times. I'm kind of a real nut about mixing. Well, I didn't even mix West Texas Blues. Chris Bell did it. And I was like, yeah, that sounds good enough, you know. Now, on other people's records, I have a higher bar, but I thought it sounded pretty good, and I thought it sounded raw.
Sounds great, man.
You know, I was like, that's what we did.
Yeah.
And so...
So, by the way, and just to be clear, you didn't... This wasn't even the plan. It was just, let's just record. You weren't thinking I'm going to release a record.
No, because then when I said, hey, Sue, I'm going to make that a record, I'm going to put it out, she couldn't believe it, because she said, well... Not because of what we played or anything, but she knows I'm so meticulous. It took me, I don't know, 5 years to make the Drifter, or 6 years. I mean, and even on her records, I mean, I don't just throw things out there. But that's what I was going to do on this one. I was like, well, it sounds good. Let's put it out. She couldn't believe I did that because I'm usually pretty methodical, more methodical with stuff. But it was also, I knew we had to make Sue's record. We were going to make it the same kind of way. We did it in the same place. It was all live. And so it was kind of, you know, I wanted to see if we could do it with my record. And then we would refine it on her record, which is what we did. You know, we got a little bit more together on her record with the sounds and everything. But it's great. And her record was the same way. I mean, I think we had 3 days. We got sounds the first day. I don't think we got anything the first day.
And that's the same cast, basically?
Same. It was... I don't like to play if I'm producing. Like, I want to be listening, because I know when you're in the studio, if you're actually playing, you don't know if something's good or bad or not. You just get done, and it could have been the most amazing take, and you wouldn't know it, usually. The band doesn't really know it a lot of times.
Yeah.
My style of producing, I always say, is press record and hold my breath, because it's alive. I always record like live. And so if it is a great take, you just hope the guy didn't drop a drumstick, or someone decides it's not working and stops it.
Right.
Someone, since like on Sue's record, it's all live vocals, like she doesn't hit a horrible note or something weird happens, right? You're just holding your breath until it gets to the end. So I like to be in the control room to be listening. So I only played on a couple of her tracks, but it was John Penner, her original bass player.
Yeah.
And then Chris Slayton played drums. And
Sue.
So... and
do you set the mood? Are you that kind of producer? Are you into that part of it, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense, like, I want everybody to be relaxed and not. I mean, like Chris Layton, while we were making Sue's record, at one point he pulled me aside. He goes, "Are we making a record?" And I was like, "Yeah, we're making a record. Don't worry," because I would just have them play, and if it wasn't working, we'd be like, oh, let's move on. Let's try, you know, let's go back to that song. Or what? Are you guys hungry? You want to go over to Torchy's?
Right.
And then, like, one day, the second day, or maybe it was, no, it was the third day, everybody seemed tired, you know. And so I said, why don't we take naps? Why don't we all take a nap? So we did. Everybody went in a little side room, and everybody fell asleep for an hour and a half or something. And then we all got back up, and we had a little something to eat. And then that's when I think almost the whole record was made, was after the nap on the second day. Because that evening, then all of a sudden, everybody, they were on fire.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we had done these songs, you know, a lot of them, but once I knew they were on fire, I was like, okay, now do this one. And now, you know, that was good. Let's go on to the next one. You had to capture the moment, you know.
Yeah.
And you never know when that moment's going to hit when you're doing a live session where you're not tracking. You know, you have to capture the moment, and that could be, who knows when that's going to be. But
yeah, yeah.
You're just crossing your fingers you get to it, because, you know, recording is expensive and you want the record to be a good one, you know.
Yeah.
And I like live recording in the sense, like, a lot of my favorite records, yeah, there's some unbelievable. I mean, it could be Hoodoo Man Blues, Junior Wells, Buddy Guy. I mean, that might have been that was their day in the studio, right? Otis Rush on the Cobra label, you know, Magic Sam on Del Mar. I mean, those guys had good days in the studio, but, you know, there was other days that weren't as great.
Mm-hmm.
Other sessions, because that's what they got that day. So you never know. I mean, you take what you get. And everything doesn't have to be great. Everything doesn't have to be the most amazing record. You know? Everything doesn't have to be for it. It just has to be good, I think.
Yeah.
This is good and fun to listen to. And, you know, so that's kind of my take. But people really, really like those records. And I think it was just because we kind of caught a good moment, or a pretty good day, you know, that
yeah.
day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Harnessing energy.
Yeah, if we had gone in a different day, you'd have a different album.
Yeah.
You know, if we hadn't taken naps that day on Sue's record, you wouldn't have the album she has now. Maybe it would have been different.
Would it interest you to do any kind of tour? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's only...
Under your thing, I'm talking
about. Oh, yeah, it's just, you know, it's difficult for me because you have to have a tour big enough where you can... You know, you got to draw people. Yeah, and for me, I got the B3, right? I got to bring a B3, or there's got to be a... Now, with Jimmy, he hauls the B3. You know, he's got a B3. When I do stuff with Gibbons, when I went on the Perfectamundo tour, I mean, we had a beautiful B3. And when I do flyouts, they always do a B3. Now, I have done gigs where one-offs, but as far as touring, it's a little hard right now because I'm doing so much with other people, and that's what I like doing. I mean, I really like working with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I understand.
I'm not
you're not trying to make it all about you and your...
No,
yeah,
I don't feel like that. Like, I like to play with people, you know,
because it takes a lot of time and energy. And
well, you have to be a certain... I mean, I think, you know, you have to be a certain person. It takes a lot to be the lead front person.
Yeah.
They work harder than everyone. They have to do all the, you know, all the... When in Jimmy's band, when the gig's over, we're done. Jimmy's out signing stuff, taking pictures, talking to people. And
right.
Right?
Right.
And it's, you know, it's all on him, you know, when we yeah. have the sound check. It's, you know, when you're a side man, boy, that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
It's just... But also the collaboration. I'm not always... You know, Jimmy really includes me in the big band, you know, where we break it down and I sing a bunch. You know, it's... I don't think I could just be in a band where it was like, okay, these are my songs, you play them the way we do them. And if you weren't here, we'd just get another guy to do it. Fortunately, I've never really been in a band like that. Like,
right.
I was always part of what was making the band.
Right.
Which is, I love. I love bands. You know, I love drummers and bass players and horn players and guitar players and
yeah.
singers. So, you know, I just love music and love being around all that, you know.
I got to ask you before we wrap it up, I noticed that picture of Keith Ferguson.
Oh, yeah.
Were you close with...
I was not close with Keith, but I did get a chance to play with him a couple times, and I did get to know him a little bit. And he's such an extraordinary bass player, and of course such an extraordinary figure in Austin music. Even more now, as you look back, what an individual he was.
Mm-hmm.
A great musician. Such style, his fashion sense. And
the whole package.
The whole package. And I remember we played with him at Antone's. It was like an afternoon Saturday gig. I can't remember. Something like that. It was me and the Moeller brothers. Keith played bass with us. And, you know, just to hang out with him and talk with him. I'll never forget it. I mean, there was people that really knew Keith and knew him well.
There's a great book on him that people don't
Yeah, know. It's a great book.
Yeah, but, Texas Blues Bass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he has such a style, and he has such a profound effect on everyone he knew. You know, the T-Birds would not have been the T-Birds. The T-Birds look like a gang, and Keith was a huge part of that. I mean, I talked to other bands. They said, you know, we were in blues bands. We were kind of in hippie blues bands, you know? Mm-hmm. And they said, the T-Birds walked in. He said, that looked like a gang, like a street gang. I mean, look at Keith with his...
Well, I guess especially Keith and Jimmy.
Yeah, especially Keith.
I'm not sure if Mike Buck looked...
Right, right. But, like, you know, Jimmy looked like...
Yeah.
You know, he looked...
Like a greaser.
Kim would have a turban on or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Like,
I forgot about the turban.
But they didn't look like a blues band from the 70s or something.
No.
They didn't look like a San Francisco blues band.
No, Keith Ferguson looked like a Chicano Los Angeles gang member.
Yeah, and he absorbed all that culture. I mean, he loved that music, and he had an extraordinary collection of all that kind of music, you know, Tejano music. I mean, that was his love, you know. I mean, and he brought all that sensibility and, you know, and you can't help but be affected by that. I mean, Doug Somm was the same way. I mean, culturally, you know, that was cool.
Yeah.
You know. And Bill Gibbons, same way. You know, I mean...
But they were ahead of their time.
They absorbed
that.
They were ahead of their time.
Like, because you know what I mean? Like, now it's...
Oh, yeah.
It's de rigueur. It's like,
absolutely.
Of course you're into that.
Absolutely.
Then...
When you saw a guy with tattoos, like Keith Ferguson, in a see-through nylon shirt with a pack of Cools in it, and a bandana. I mean, you don't even see guys like
that. See, again, you're right. It's like Paul Simonon from The Clash, that bass...
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Keith, these are these two style icons.
Yeah,
like you're saying, that's the other thing they brought to the table. Is just,
and it's very important in music. People forget that about music is that we are in show business.
Yeah,
and we're there for the people, and nobody gets that more than Billy. And it's great too. I'm around Gibbons a lot and Jimmy a lot, and they're both very conscious about how they look on stage.
Billy's always Billy. By the way, I will add this. Yeah. I was on a plane once, and I saw him on an airplane, and I saw him in some place in L.A., I don't know. But he always looked like Billy Gibbons.
Always looks like Billy.
There is no...
No.
This is my...
No.
Off-the-clock look.
No.
No.
They are those guys.
Yeah.
And Jimmy's like that. They're like that. They are those people.
Yeah.
That's not a get up. I mean, there is a But
it's a way of life.
Going back to Keith Ferguson, I mean, they all represented, hey, I'm going to look cool on stage. I'm cool off stage. I'm, you know, what I'm playing is cool.
Yeah.
Right? Like, all those guys subscribe to that. Like, it's not what you play, it is, but it's also, is it cool?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like if it's not cool.
Well, that first Thunderbirds record is...
Oh,
come on.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere.
I always tell people who don't have any idea, it's like, well, get a clue.
Yeah. I mean, I came up during when Texas Flood hit and Steve Ray Vaughan was huge.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But when I was coming up in Dallas, I didn't know anyone trying to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan. Everyone's trying to play like the T-Birds and Jimmy. I didn't know anybody that was trying to play like Stevie. It probably seemed impossible. You know, not that there weren't people following that path, but the T-Birds were the big influence, you know. And for all those reasons, because they were so cool and the music was cool and girls danced to it, you know.
Always helps.
And it still, to this day, if we don't have girls dancing like at Seaboys.
Yeah, you pull out the crawl.
Yeah, the crawl.
Like, talk about it, and you get them dancing.
That's what we do. You know, we want the people to have fun, and we want to have a good time, and we're in show business. I mean, we do know we're in show business.
I love that attitude. It's refreshing, you know.
Yeah, it's not really about us or any of that. I mean, it's about the people and about, you know, if you go to a show at Seaboys, I mean, Jimmy's going to have his custom tailored suit on. I mean, and he's going to have a spur. He has a spur on one of his boots.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's got the
just
chain.
The guitar strap and the
Guitar strap is Texas and JLV on it, and I mean
the whole thing, man.
And it, but his whole life is, he loves cool stuff. All those cool cars, the styles. You know, Billy too, like they do those custom cars. I mean, they're very serious about how cool stuff is.
Yeah.
Which I love. I mean, I'm not that cool, but I love to be around cool people like that, you know. Hoping a little rubs off along the way. You know?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I love it, man.
Anyway.
Man, Mike Flanagan, folks. Again, go check out the new album, West Texas Blues. Yeah. I love it.
Thank you. It sounds great.
And if you're in Austin, come check them out. I mean, you're going to be doing Seaboys a lot, I take it.
We're doing Seaboys a bunch. And then we're also doing the Jungle Show at the end of December.
That's right.
At Antone's with me. Billy Gibbons, Jimmy Vaughn, Chris Whipper-Layton, and Sue. It's the one time a year we get together and play, you know, all together. And that's always fun. I think I can't remember the exact dates, 27th, 28th, or 28th, 29th, I can't remember. But it's at Antone's at the end of
December. End of the year. Love it, man. Mike, thank you, man, for having me over today.
Yeah, Dave, thanks, man.
Right on, man.